division of the county of Kent. Between the towns of Maidstone and Rochester lies a stretch of road called Bluebell Hill. It's known locally as the Turnlock, on account of its many twisting bends. It was on one of these bends that one wet Friday night in 1965, three young women came to their deaths. The woman driving the car was to have been married the following day, with her two passengers as bridesmaids. Between the junction for Lovebell and the hangway turning, their car skidded and left the road before colliding with a copse of fir trees.
And so finally, after 2 years of discussion, we assembled one cold Saturday morning in a large empty lecture theatre to begin the filming. I arrived a little late to find Sanderson and Ball already set up with multiple projections, playing footage from Green on the Horizon and Hangway Turning. I won't do that again. It's surely projectors, not multiple projector. Yeah, projectors, not projections.
I mean, just before you answer, like the idea of you revisiting for the sake of it or for playfulness or something, when I said about being more specific, I would want it to be like you wanted to revisit, I don't know, one particular shot in the three films. There is something slightly absurd, but at the same time specific about that, that as myself I can kind of get my hands around. So maybe it's that particular location or how that location's framed at that time and that one individual shot, or it just all feels a bit vague.
This is not a game or competition. There are no prizes to be won.
There are no prizes.
Times to be beaten.
Times to be beaten.
Rules to follow.
Or rules to follow.
You are on your own.
You are on your own.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's programme, we have two guests in the studio, Stephen Ball and Philip Sanderson. Stephen Ball is research fellow at the Film and Video Study Collection at Central St. Martin's.
That's right.
Stephen, is that about right?
That's roughly there, yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay. And Philip Sanderson is an artist, filmmaker, sound
person.
And the two of you have recently released or previewed or shown a new film called Film of the Same Name, which, as the introduction sort of hints at, both your names are sort of mentioned there. It's a sort of quite a mysterious project to people coming to it for the first time. There is an introduction about sort of a hint of a ghost story, I think. Perhaps, and the whole film is a reworking of earlier films. I think the two of you go back to what, 1978?
Indeed, yes.
Yes,
well,
at least.
We knew each other at school, but 78 was probably about when we started doing some music, electronic sound stuff under the name of Stormbugs at that point.
Right.
And this was about 10 years later, the first of the pieces that we've revisited.
Yeah, it would have been sort of the mid
80s, 85, 86, when we started. Mm-hmm.
So just to, you were at school together, where?
Yeah.
In Rochester.
In Rochester.
In Rochester,
yeah,
which is the sort of the location of this film.
Yes.
2014,
yeah.
many years later, in fact.
Yes, we grew up, as it were, in the Medway towns and went to school in Rochester. Right. And then later I went to Maidstone Art College. So that kind of area, I mean, one of the films is located entirely on Bluebell Hill, which is actually the stretch of road between Maidstone and Rochester. So it's that kind of vicinity that we're looking at, the Medway towns and right. sort of close to.
So it is a trilogy called what, Apostrophe S, is that right?
That was the original, yes. In the 80s, when we began to work this up, we started with the ghost story. I mean, having, as you said, grown up in that area, we were aware of this sort of apocryphal tale of this woman. And it would happen every few years in the newspaper, there would be ghosts sighted on Bluebell Hill, and there'd be a bit of a little buzz, you know, in the local paper about... Uh-huh. What had happened, you know, someone had been driving their car down Bluebell Hill, you know, at late in the evening and spotted this woman hitchhiking on the side of the road, would pick her up. She asked to get into the back of the car. This is the kind of routine it would follow.
Yeah.
And then as they get to the bottom of the hill, the driver turns around and she's disappeared. And this would happen periodically. So we were kind of aware of that story, and that was a kind of starting point, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of urban myth that crops up all over the place. I mean, there is actually a book, I can't remember,
The
Vanishing Hitchhiker, which actually follows the various kind of versions and iterations of that particular myth across the world.
This specific one, or you mean this idea of it's a recurring
the
thing
idea
of a vanishing hitchhiker?
Vanishing hitchhiker recurs in a number of different places. However, what we and so we kind of absorbed the local version of that.
Right.
Through growing up in the area, you know, you would hear about it, as Philip says. But what we decided to do was to actually see if we could find any actual kind of factual evidence for these events occurring in, you know, in the real world, not in the sort of world of urban myths and so on. So
just to be clear, the accident in question took place in 1965.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
Could you just briefly describe what the incident was, what happened?
Well, essentially, as reported, and seems reasonably accurate, that there was a woman who was going to be married the following day, and she was on her way with her sort of coterie of bridesmaids to this pub. Now, the story sometimes varies as to whether they were just going out for a kind of hen night or to meet her fiancé. Either way, somewhere down the road, which at the time was much narrower. It's now a dual carriageway, but at the time it was a much narrower road. Mm-hmm. And as the title suggests, it's quite a steep hill. The car was supposed to have skidded, left the road, collided with a tree or trees. And, you know, the police were called, da-da-da-da-da, and she was... slightly differences. Some scenarios suggest she died at the scene, others that she died when she got to the hospital. But, you know, there are newspaper reports and a photograph of the car and so on and so forth. So that actually did happen.
Right.
And the idea is that the ghost sightings then start a little while later.
Okay. So that's 1965.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to ask you how old. Yes, how old were you?
Would have been five at that point.
Right.
Very keen.
Yeah. So it was much later.
Yes.
But you grew up with this kind of...
Well, it would happen every few years. There would be a thing in the local paper about someone having... experienced
a ghost hitchhiker or whatever,
and always claiming that they'd never heard of the crash. They'd always say, you know, I picked up this woman, she disappeared.
Yeah.
Normally what they would do is then go to the police, and the police would go, oh, all right, son, yeah, we've heard this one before. And they'd go, but I never heard about the crash.
So, right.
So this would pop up. So we were aware of that.
Right, okay.
But then what was quite interesting is, again, we were also aware that very close to Bluebell Hill, there are two kind of Neolithic burial sites. So there's the countless stones at the bottom of the hill, and then there's Kit's Coty at the top, which is, you know, it's kind of this sort of structure. Good. And so
you've done something with your hands there.
Yeah, this is radio.
It's like Stonehenge type thing.
Yes,
a very, very small.
Two uprights and a horizontal.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay. That kind of thing. Yeah. Yes.
And that's the one that actually there's an image of that in the earlier film with a fence around it.
Yes.
So it's a sort of protected site or something. Yes. So there is reverence for this place in that area.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's considered to be an important kind of local landmark as a Neolithic burial ground or wet it, whatever
right.
it is.
Okay.
And so, along with that, you then get the other inevitable things, ley lines.
Right.
Again, in the 70s, much talk of nefarious nighttime activities.
Yeah.
So you've got a picture began to develop of a kind of quite a busy area, despite being a lonely little lane.
Yeah.
So I think it's true to say that, we weren't particularly interested in trying to make a documentary about the ghost story or necessarily be too concerned about the factual evidence. Mm-hmm. But there were some quite interesting ideas. I mean, one of them, ones which is in a number of books, is about this idea of an incident occurring and somehow imprinting itself on the landscape. And then somehow this something triggers it to play it back. It's an idea that's used also in the Stone Tapes, that 70s TV.
Nope. Hotters. Sorry, I don't know that one. It's a whole world that I haven't really dabbled in or haven't ventured into this.
Well, we're luring you in, will you?
Indeed, yes, you are actually. Yes.
Come over to the dark side.
Come on, in the lights, please.
Well, are you in the dark side?
It's called psychometry, isn't it?
This is the question.
Phenomenon.
Say that again, please.
It's called psychometry, the idea that memories and events and emotions can be somehow imprinted within the landscape, within objects. And it's often used to account for things like poltergeist activity and that kind of stuff. Mm. In one of the earlier films that we're revisiting, Hangway Turning, you see a character who is doing a lot of dowsing, for example, around the standing stones and burial sites. So there are links that have been made with the activity of dowsing, both in terms of finding, fairly sort of mundane things like underground water courses, but also within those underground water courses, it is assumed that there is some kind of energy that comes from some sort of traumatic activity or whatever happening in that area. So, I mean, I think this is all rather spurious, but it was great kind
really?
Of...
you tell me this now? After all these years?
Yes, after 20 years of activity. It's like, but no, that's fair enough, because maybe that's your conclusion.
But perhaps it was great.
Did you think it was spurious to start with?
Oh, yes. I've long been a cynic.
But it was an interesting... You can immediately see, exactly, even though we were still in the analogue phase then, it was as if one was aware that the analogue phase was coming to an end, even though the digital hadn't really happened. Hmm. And this whole idea of recording somehow onto the land and then somehow playing it back is obviously very analogous to how you record on film and tape. So it was quite an interesting... I don't think either of us necessarily had any particular belief in it, but it was obviously a very interesting mechanism which paralleled the whole filming and recording process. Mm. You're being very sceptical.
I'm trying to understand this. I'm not sure I get the parallel with analog.
Well, if you think about magnetic tape in particular, you've got a bunch basically of iron particles on there. You have a magnetic field that goes across it. The particles all readjust.
Right.
Consequently,
okay.
Then it's played back. The charge is created in relation to the particles. I'm probably getting this wrong on resonance, and then the signal's created. So it's kind of a very similar process,
right?
That's being described by people when they say that the traumatic event occurs, the landscape is somehow changed. Often also mentioning some kind of magnetic thing as well, isn't there?
And another aspect of this, which is slightly to move away from the kind of the purely sort of supernatural, sort of paranormal kind of activity, is also the question of ley lines. And ley lines were actually discovered by a guy called Alfred Watkins in the 1930s, who was a sort of enthusiastic amateur photographer. Who went out into the landscape. There's a book called The Old Straight Track, which is his sort of, you know, his description of the process of discovering ley lines. So he went out into the landscape. He took lots of photographs of, you know, landscape photography. And then he discovered, partly by accident, that certain features in the landscape appear to line up. You know, when you point a camera at them, they appear to be in alignment with each other. And these features were things like footpaths across fields, you know, right. ancient trackways, churches, fords, crossings on the river. So he then double-checked with Ordnance Survey maps and discovered that, yes, indeed, you could draw lines across the countryside, and along those lines would fall things like footpaths, churches, burial grounds, etc.
Yeah.
Now, to all intents and purposes, that makes perfect sense, that ancient civilizations historically would have followed a straight track because it's the quickest way to get from one place to another, obviously, and so there would be gaps and they would build churches and they would have burial grounds along the same kind of lines. So this was his great discovery, but subsequent to that, it then became kind of adopted by people who had these much more kind of paranormal beliefs, that believed that these ley lines also represented kind of more kind of, psychic energy forces across the landscape.
The actual things that you mentioned, churches, streams, ponds, were kind of nodes in a sort of connecting energy grid, as it were.
But do they converge on this area then? Is there something specific about this area?
There's a large number
of them. You tend to find a lot of ley lines, obviously, around where you'd have Neolithic burial sites. So obviously there's a very busy amount of ley lines in the West Country, and quite a few are meant to converge on Bluebell Hill.
Okay.
So, but another aspect of this is going back to the idea of landscape photography. And so there is an element of the work, I think, that also links itself to a sort of whole experimental film practice of landscape film. So I'm thinking, people like Chris Wellesby, but also people like... got a mental blank. What's his name? The guy who...
I don't know which guy you're talking about now.
Richard Long.
Richard Long.
And those walks, straight lines across the land, and that kind of work. So there was a way that I think that we were sort of also working through the idea of sort of maybe more of a kind of formal film process and kind of looking at that in relation to these sort of myths and urban stories and so on.
I think my first reaction is to say people like Chris Wellesby and Richard Long are not sort of actually concerned with what we might call the paranormal.
No, exactly.
In a way, what you're doing does give credence to this myth.
I think it's more that, I mean, it's quite interesting because in the last, five, maybe 10 years, there's been this term hauntological has been employed by many people, which is, and I'm sure there's been other resonance programs on it, but a kind of bastardization to some extent of the original concept of hauntology. Being applied specifically, ghost box in terms of sound and so on and so forth. But often they seem to be, despite saying that they're not, they're willfully spooky. So playing with many of these same ideas, but trying to create, or the impression seems to be that they're trying to create a recreation of often 70s sort of spookiness. I think what we in part were doing was somewhat playing with these ideas, and it's interesting. Stephen's mentioned, of course, some artists like Richard Long and so on. Now, of course, the thing with Richard Long is he always seems to be very serious about things. I'm not saying that we were running around doing a Monty Python sketch, but we were being very playful with the ideas, and to some extent that has on occasion been problematic with the reception, because of course the great body of British avant-garde structural materialist filmmakers and people coming out of that, notions of pastiche, parody, and so on and so forth aren't things that you often find within that, because they're still very much within what I would call a modernist trajectory.
Right.
And a modernist trajectory is very much about exploring aspects of the medium, the anti-illusory qualities and all of those sorts of Godard-type things.
Yeah.
So in our different ways, I'm not saying that we necessarily, completely think one and the same thing on these things, but we were aware of that, but also in part playing with some of those things. So, I mean,
so the style of your film is not that of a straight documentary. There is a degree of sort of what, for the, what I'll call it experimentalism or avant-gardism in the style of the filmmaking. But I mean, I didn't. I've seen the film twice, and I've also seen the earlier two films, which you made in the 80s. I didn't really get. I didn't get a feeling of parody about them. I mean, I. It seems to me that you take it seriously.
Oh dear.
there is an element.
You well, know, you've completely failed then, haven't you?
Yeah, because you've sort of the. We should say that the there is this trilogy, apostrophe S, as you called it. You've made two films. Was it in the '80s? One was on Super 8. And features, perhaps you could describe one of them. Is it Green on the Horizon?
The project, which started off as, perhaps we should explain, the project started off focused around Bluebell Hill, but then somewhat, perhaps in a grandiose fashion, expanded outwards to include another part of the project, which was on the nearby Cliff Marshes, where Boris has been very keen to build his airport.
Oh, yeah.
And the character from the first thing, the character of Judith Langham, the woman, young woman who was killed in the car crash, her ghost, as you, Stephen, mentioned earlier, becomes the person who then travels across this landscape of Cliff Marshes to reach a fort.
And so this is like a fictional narrative on your part?
Yes.
Taking the character, so you've taken the ghost of the person that died in the car crash. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And you've placed her, you have her on a bicycle cycling around the marshes.
Yeah.
So this is a complete projection of yours, as it were. I mean, we don't, the woman was never a cyclist.
No, as far as we know.
Okay. All right.
And of course, we to confuse matters even more, we made that one before we did the ghost one.
Right.
You see, okay. what
which
happened?
Is the ghost one? Which is the ghost?
Hangway Turning was the one that focused on Bluebell Hill originally.
With a different character in it?
No, the same character.
Is she in that?
Yeah.
I thought that it was mostly a guy dowsing.
That's Thomas Cubitt.
Yeah. And I've got to consult my notes. There's somebody playing Thomas Cubitt.
Yes.
You've almost got the credits say something like, where is it now? Fowler, who is William Fowler,
yes,
who is a well-known curator of film at the British Film Institute.
Indeed, yes.
The credits say Fowler as Nigel Jacqueline as Thomas Cubitt.
Yes. Thomas Cubitt is a character that we sort of extrapolated from. He was originally a sort of architect or something.
Master builder.
Master builder. Who we turned into this ghost hunter. Somehow. I'm not quite sure how that
happened.
Dowser and Ghost Hunter. But he became the Ghost Hunter who then, in a sense, the unmade work could become a kind of fairly cohesive narrative if we really put our minds to it. But it never happened that way. But in terms of that, so Thomas Cubitt is the fictional character based on somebody who was a master builder who
lived in the area.
Else.
Right.
Nigel Jacqueline was the person who played Thomas Cubitt in the original Hangway Turning film, and then Will Fowler was brought in as the person who would then try to reenact the role of Thomas Cubitt via Nigel Jacqueline's portrayal of him in Hangway Turning. And also Lee Milsom, who took the role of Angela Staples, who was the woman who played the ghost cycling and being hit by a car on the road in Hangway Turning or whatever's happening to her there, who was called Judith Langham.
Right.
So that should be quite simple now.
I mean, this is obviously all tied up with the remake.
Let's get to the remake, because why remake it after you've made two Super 8 films in the 80s which touch on this subject?
Yeah.
And then in 2014 you've produced this new film called Film of the Same Name,
yes,
which incorporates imagery and action. In fact, we see things like you multiple projections with, say, in the background on the screen, you see the earlier film of the woman cycling around the marshes.
Yeah.
And then in front of the screen, casting a shadow, is it the same actress or have you got someone?
No, this is the whole
this
thing.
This is Lee.
This is the thing okay, that Will and Lee,
yep.
They're not dead ringers, but they look very similar to the two people who played the first film.
Yeah.
Or similar enough that if you were using the kind of trope of the remake, you know, like they're working on a Dad's Army remake, and for reasons best known to them, they seem to have tried to find a whole bunch of actors who look quite a lot like you know, John Lemessurier, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. So adopting that trope of the remake where you find people who look like the original, we found that almost conveniently, two people that
we knew
actually looked quite a lot like the two original people who'd originally played the parts.
Okay. Yeah. So then you have them sort of basically mimicking or emulating the movements that they see on the screen.
Reenacting.
Yeah. Thank you. So they will do a turn and they're looking, and then as they're doing this, they cast a shadow. So basically you've almost got like three images of the same person. Sort of this recurs throughout the film with various scenes, doesn't it? We're incorporating the older films. But so this brings us to 2014.
Yes.
Why have you basically remade the film at this point in time?
Well, I think we came to a point where we felt that in some way or other, which is slightly intangible, we couldn't even put our own fingers on it particularly, but in some way or other, the project had never really been finished. I think it was partly because of the sort of fragmentary way that the two original films became made. As we've said, the second one was made first, as it were, and then the second film, Hangway Turning, which Philip made after I'd left the country, but Philip made that from a lot of the research material that we'd unearthed when we were earlier on in the piece. So so those two films, for a start, they kind of came out the wrong way round, as it were. Mm-hmm. But also because they became two sort of fairly discrete projects in their own right, we felt that there was a way that we could revisit them and try to somehow extricate something about them that was going, you know, something that they had that as a project, as a whole, that we could revisit. Now, this is particularly in the light, as Philip said earlier, of the relatively recent interest in notions of hauntology, which we kind of then map onto our project, in spite of the fact that what we were doing completely predates.
Could you briefly define what hauntology is? I mean, apart from the obvious sort of basically a belief in ghosts?
Not necessarily. No, it's more to do with ways that the past reoccurs in the present. But a lot of kind of contemporary hauntology, by contemporary I mean within the last 10 years or so, harks back to Derrida's use of the first of the word initially in his Spectres of Marx book. So he's writing about the spectre of communism that haunts post-Soviet society. So, I mean, intellectual society. He's sort of writing about how Marxism then becomes sort of something that we have to kind of revisit post-communist society. So there's the specter of Marx is the kind of the form of the past haunting the present through a sort of another event that's happened. Well, in a way, hauntological ways of kind of describing things have somehow followed that sort of process, but with a different set of kind of relationships and cultural media.
Is hauntology in its true sense, then? It is a sort of political kind of metaphor?
In its original form, it is, yes. It is about this notion that, you know, post the wall coming down, in a sense, communism is supposed to have been defeated in favor of capitalism. And I think what Derrida is saying, I'm probably not articulating this well, is that nonetheless, despite this defeat, that the political intellectual climate is still haunted by this possibility of Marxism.
Right.
So Marxism, you know, has in a sense been defeated, but it hangs in the air. In the context of how it's then been applied specifically in Britain, or maybe even in England, it's interesting because it's actually, despite the fact that it's not supposed to be anything to do in the Derrida sense with actual ghosts, a lot of the people who've described their works as hauntological seem to be talking about ghosts.
Exactly, right. Whereas, so there's a bit of a leap there, isn't
there? Yeah, in Derrida's terms, it was a kind of pun. He is the, you know, the it's a pun on ontology. Ontology, hauntology, you know. Oh, okay. So it's about the ontology of certain
sort of
ways,
essence of something.
The essence of something, which in a sense you can kind of see how contemporary hauntology is also involved in that kind of thinking and reappraising the way that certain kind of cultural forms had haunt the present. And then revisiting that and reworking that in one
which
way.
Which is the way it's been used in the UK, in the sense there's been a, you know, as we've said, mentioned, and I'm not making comments for or against their work, some of which I've quite enjoyed, but like the ghost box thing, when you see a CD or LP, at first glance, it looks like a sort of library record, perhaps, from the 1970s, or it has that aura of the 1970s about it. And so they're interpreting the hauntological in a way which is a little bit like this whole idea of seeing something and at first you're not sure where it's situated. Is this a kind of extract from an episode of Tomorrow's World about synthesizers that you vaguely remember seeing in 74 or something, that kind of thing.
Right.
But in a sense, our approach to the hauntological is a lot closer to the original Derrida, because we're just using it as a trope that you were suggesting earlier that you've taken it quite seriously.
Yes. I certainly didn't see it as a parody as such. I just saw them as sort of an avant-garde-ish style of not wanting to be too definitive about the subject. In other words, you're leaving it open-ended.
Yes.
You're not actually, say, coming down, you know, squarely one way or the other. But at the same time, I didn't see it as humorous. I mean, there are kind of moments of particularly when it's you pointing.
Yes.
There's a sort of, which is, it's not exactly humorous, but it's not exactly serious either. But it is as though I don't know whether you guys believe this or not, you see. At the end of it, I'm thinking, they actually believe this stuff?
Often the two would overlap. So, for example, in Green on the Horizon, one of the ideas is that when you go across this marshland, because of the way it's been arranged, there's a number of little water things that intersperse the fields. It's actually very easy to get lost. Lost in the sense that you can clearly see where you're heading for, but you go to the corner, oh no, we can't cross there. You then transfer to the edge of the field, and then you end up doubling back to find the one part where you can then cross over. Whereas instead of being able to go straight ahead, because of all the water that's in between the fields, these little kind of, you know, streams almost, you then end up having to go in a rather convoluted way.
So is this a sort of metaphor that in order to get to a point, you might not be able to go in a straight line, you might actually have to go back on yourself and around the houses and turn left.
But then what?
So there is a deliberate metaphor at work.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the shortest distance between two points is not necessarily always a straight line.
Okay.
But of course, then what happens is when we're doing our remake and we're going on our exploratory journey back to Cliff Marshes, we get there, and you know, obviously it's been a number of years since we've been there, but broadly speaking, could vaguely remember which way to navigate to get to the shore as quickly as possible. Right. However, there'd been a lot of rain, so the normal path was blocked off, so we had to take a side route, and promptly did exactly what happened.
Right.
Was, of course, that we don't exactly get lost, but it takes us best part of the entire morning to travel about 1 mile.
Right.
And that's the footage you see of us
waving around bits of paper saying, is it that way or that way? Yeah.
Who was the man with the rifle?
We don't know. He was just there.
Right.
That was very peculiar.
It's a figure in a camouflage sort of uniform. Yeah. You can't tell if he's a militaristic person or whether he's just a sort of hunter who dresses up like a soldier or something.
Yeah, that building itself, it's probably maybe not quite so clear, is an old Napoleonic fort, or a fort that dates from the Napoleonic Wars, which is on the edge of Cliff Marshes. Right. And in the original Green on the Horizon, that was the ostensible destination for the ghost of Judith Langham on her bicycle, who is taking cues and directions from this little reel-to-reel tape recorder that she's carrying around with her. So as part of our revisiting of the landscape in which that was shot, we had to find our way to the fort. And when we got there, there was this guy with a gun, and we don't know why he was there, but you know, we had to capture some video of him to
It was very peculiar because as you say, he's fully togged up.
Yeah.
It's not any longer a military base.
Right.
His rifle looked reasonably legitimate.
Yes. But the other telescopic sight on it.
The other thing, of course, is that immediately it looks like some sort of little extract from, you know, Jarman's Last of England or something.
Right.
So that was actually sort of, you know, I mean, most of the things were sort of fortuitous kind of coincidences. And that's almost simultaneously what Stephen was doing this footage of this chap, then it's kind of little James Bond type helicopter thing.
Oh, yeah. That's right. The yellow, what do you call those things? It's like a solo, there's a special name for it, isn't there?
I don't know.
I can't remember now.
It's like a one-man helicopter
flying very low, and he comes over the top.
He comes over the top at that moment.
Yeah.
It's all very peculiar, really.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, indeed.
But I think going back to the question of, you know, why we decided to revisit it, which is where we've kind of digressed from.
I thought we were trying to avoid that, yes.
Well, I mean, it was to do very much with this idea that we didn't really think we'd kind of finished the project somehow, but also the fact that these notions of hauntology, as we've discussed, have become current, and we kind of thought, well, we were sort of doing a version of that before, but also the other and more kind of formal reason, in a sense, in terms of the, you know, the formal qualities of the work, is that recently there have been a lot of artist filmmakers who are making work that one way or another appropriates the tropes of documentary and the forms of documentary, and also the use of things like Super 8 film and so on, and you know, and work that very specifically highlights the qualities of the medium of the film, even if they're not necessarily materialist films as such. So we thought that the sort of convergence of all these things now, it seemed to be a good time to revisit our work and see what came out of that revisitation, and so the film of the same name is what came out of that revisitation. That's what happened as a result of doing it. So
right.
I mean, I think that's all true.
Good.
However, there was also the other idea of there was quite appealing about, you know, when they make the remake, and some films have been remade several times.
Yeah,
they're almost invariably much worse than the original film. So everyone's already saying, I know, brought up Dad's Army, that well-known existentialist classic. But everyone's already saying, it's going to be terrible, isn't it? You know, what a bad idea. Yeah. Why are they doing this?
Yes.
And invariably, there's this idea of a classic, and, you know, someone in Hollywood thinks, okay, we can milk a bit more by remaking this thing. So it was quite an appealing idea there, where probably nobody, in this instance, you see, even though the films did quite well, inverted commas, i.e. were shown at festivals and got reviewed at the time, hardly anybody remembers them, not surprisingly. So I quite liked the inversion of the idea that, you know, we were remaking something which, you know, we could almost have made up.
Yeah, we could be making a fictional remake of a couple of kind of experimental films that were made in the mid-80s that were never really made, and this whole thing becomes like, you know, it's a bit like a kind of Peter Greenaway sort of exercise with Tulse Looper or something.
That brings me to a question which I had, but because the only problem, well, not the only problem, but I suppose
one of several.
One problem that I do have with this is that, of course, there is a very serious issue at the basis of this thing, and that is there was a car crash in which three people died. So all of the rest is kind of based on what was a tragedy, of course. And I wonder what the person that was going to get married the following day and died in this car crash. I mean, there is a serious story here. Around which has been constructed these myths and ghost stories. I mean, have there been any kind of repercussions or has there been any feedback from, say, the person's family as to this, you know, as to this myth around her death?
Not as far as I know. And they've actually, you know, at the time, as I say, the thing was limited to articles in whatever it was, the Kent Messenger or something, I think, whatever. And in those articles, there was never any mention of the family's response to it.
Right.
Since there's been this multiplicity of TV channels, you know, and there's some kind of paranormal channel or something, isn't it? I don't know. But that on YouTube, you can find a program made for one of those low-budget TV channels about the hitchhiker thing and revisiting this thing as well. Mm. And these are done in a much more conventional fashion with some slightly spooky footage shot on Bluebell Hill at night and paranormal experts brought in and things. But again, there's no... There's never been any mention of the family or the family being, you know, concerned one way or the other.
No.
So, I mean, I can see the point you're making, and I think that might have been problematic if the car crash had occurred last year or something, if you see what I mean. But already by the time we were looking at it in the 80s, it seemed to be kind of quite ancient history. I mean, we're talking 1965, it was already 20 years after that.
Right.
So presumably her parents probably may have even been, you know, dead by the time we had made. Plus also at that point, you know, it was being shown in a kind of quite a rarefied context. It wasn't being shown on, you know, BBC.
But you know, the hitchhiker myth, are they usually based on a real event? Or
there is normally a trigger. So wherever the story crops up over the world, there's normally an allusion to a trigger. However, interestingly, on Bluebell Hill, it turns out that with a bit more digging, there's actually ghost sightings that predate the 65 crash.
Okay.
There's even talk of a ghost sighting from the days of the coach and horses.
Right.
So clearly...
So it is a haunted area. There's something apparently supposedly going on. Or do you think maybe if you dig around in almost any area, you might find similar stories. Especially, you know, like here down in near London Bridge, there's all manner of...
And in this resonance studio, I'm sure.
Oh, don't say that. Anyway, all right, so let's talk about your film previewed, a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we did a little preview screening by invitation only, so it hasn't actually had a public screening yet. So if anybody listening to this is interested in curating it into a program...
Yeah, and tell me about the preview. It was an interesting venue, I think. You had
It was at the British Board of Film Censors Preview Theatre, which is actually a very nice little... theatre. And we chose it, I mean, I'll be, you know, quite honest about it, the reason we chose that place was it's one of the cheapest we could find.
Oh, really?
Because
that's surprising.
Preview theatres are quite expensive. But they had a very good setup, and it was just the right sort of size for what we needed. So
Is that Soho Square?
Soho Square, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And how many people attended the...
Thousands.
We had to turn them away in the end. I mean, they would round the clock.
Roughly, come on.
15?
Yes. Okay.
It was small screening on a Monday evening. It was really for people who'd been involved in the project and other people who may have been involved in interested in it. So it was never intended to be a kind of a gala premiere event. Okay. It was more of a preview screening. Yeah.
Okay. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with Philip Sanderson and Stephen Ball talking about their new film, Film of the Same Name, which is available for distribution, presumably. It's out there somewhere.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, you know, in our pre-Costa Coffee discussion, we're saying how the first film, Green on the Horizon, had been distributed via what was then an embryonic film and video umbrella through their Electric Eyes program.
Yes, yeah.
It was interesting, though, because you said the films were shot on Super 8. They're actually shot on Super 8 and then edited on video.
Okay.
And without wanting to revisit this in great detail, that actually at the time posed interesting problems because, as you know, there was the Film Co-op and London Video Arts.
Yep.
And the Film Co-op, though it would accept things on tape, it was never very happy about them. And LVA weren't very happy about things that they thought had been shot on film. And I actually had conversations with people saying, well, this is more, you know, video arts thing. And them saying, no, this is more Film Co-op or something. But interestingly, in Europe, because the Hangway Turning was shown, I think, in Osnabrück, they didn't have that problem. You know, it was a kind of quite... I suppose it was part of the end of that separation between those two organizations.
Right.
But of course, I think we made the film the length that it came out. But I think once we'd finished it, we thought we realized actually we've come up with quite an odd length of 35 minutes because, you know, there's a plethora of film festivals throughout the world. And to be honest, if, you know, your piece is 5 minutes and you're reasonably assiduous and send it off, you know, it's not too difficult to get your film shown if it's under, you know, right. 5 to 10 minutes. Yeah, 35 minutes, of course, will make a bit more of a major commitment on the part of the programmer. So,
right.
I mean, I'm not saying that we've submitted it to lots of places and had a negative reaction, but it probably will be more difficult.
Well, you allowed me to see it on Vimeo, of course.
Yes.
We're using your sort of password.
Yeah.
Is that an outlet for, is that where you would want it to be seen generally or not? Or is that just for sort of preview, you know?
I think, I mean, I still think that certainly for this film, because it's, you know, it's a single screen film that has, you know, has a duration. It has a beginning and a middle and an end, even though they could be interchanged. I think for this kind of work, the optimum context for screening it would be in a sort of cinema type screening space where people come in, sit down, watch the film, and then go away, rather than installed in a space on a loop, which is quite a common mode of showing films these days. So I think because of the nature of the work, it suits being shown in a cinematic space. And that preview screening was kind of interesting because it was the first time we'd seen it in that context. The only time we'd seen the work before was on our computers. So,
right.
So in a way, if it's going to be shown online, it doesn't really move away from the sort of mode of viewing that is part of its production, in a sense, which is a kind of interesting thing, I suppose, because that's certainly sort of fairly common experience of watching work these days, that people will watch them online. I don't know. I think we've thought primarily about it as being a kind of cinematic piece in the sense that it will be shown in a screening. But as Philip says, it's an awkward length to be put in a shorts program. I mean, one option, which is a possibility, would be to show the two earlier films and film of the same name within the same program. Mm. Then there would be, it would, you know, it would form much more of a kind of conventional programming slot, as it were, and would kind of make sense because you can kind of see one in relation to the other.
Yeah.
But you know whether anybody is willing to take that on.
Now, when we first mentioned this idea a couple of weeks ago of coming on the show, I did Google Bluebell Hill.
Yes.
And was astonished to find that almost on the same day that I'd Googled Bluebell Hill, there was a sort of an announcement online that somebody has made a documentary.
I've been trying to do a... I mean, there've been a few. There's one online. Well, it was online, whether it still is, which was clearly a student production. I don't know whether they were affiliated with the college, but they'd actually gone on the hill and they'd reenacted the... So it seems to pop up every now and then. I think the project you were referring to gives the impression that they're going to spend a bit more money. This one I was talking about looked like it had been made with no budget, you know. Whether it's going to happen, I don't know.
But so there are other people out there who are
following in our footsteps.
Indeed. Well, yes, because yours was the first, wasn't it, presumably?
It was, yes.
And yours is presumably a sort of unique take on it because of its avant-garde-ish style.
Well, also because the
style.
Going back to the question of, in a sense, why we remade it, not refuting anything we said earlier, but one of the interesting things was, of course, that we had these two disparate parts, the one on the marshes, Grid on the Horizon, the Hangway Turning. And of course, it was, well, how do they fit together, really? And so it was quite interesting that we've now combined them into one piece, which, again, still posed problems when we were making it. How do these two different elements?
Well, at the end of the day, what is your view on the whole thing? You're looking slightly skeptical. I mean, do you believe in it? Or is it?
You mean the ghost sightings or the. I believe as much as I did at the time in the idea.
Okay,
I mean the attraction was always the idea. of, as I say, this, as I was saying earlier, this notion of something being imprinted and then somehow being replayed. That was always the interesting idea. And again, you know, by revisiting, we're kind of trying to replay both what occurred originally and our own work. So that's integrated into the notion, as you were describing.
That's a very elaborate sidestepping of the...
well, your question is really a question of whether we believe that... I mean, to put it very, very simply, whether there is such a thing as ghosts that haunt the world that are, you know, that are kind of... have some connection with a physical human
and
being.
This hitchhiker story.
And this hitchhiker story.
Yeah. What do you think?
I believe that people believe that it has happened in the sense that I believe that...
Well,
there are credible reports that people pick somebody up on the hill and she disappeared by the time they got to the bottom of the hill or whatever version of the story you happen to read. I believe that those people believe it. And but whether in fact there is such a thing as a ghost that is, or ghosts generally that do kind of inhabit the world in some way that is kind of parallel to the physical world that we all believe that we inhabit, I really couldn't say. I couldn't say I believe it.
But they're all projections in the end.
It's a projection.
In the end, they're all projections because the figure it also fits within the kind of notions of femininity, doesn't it? Because the driver's always male. There's not, as far as I know, been an account of a woman driving who stopped. Perhaps women don't pick up hitchhikers in the same way, but a woman driving may well pick up a woman hitchhiker.
Yes.
But the driver's always male. The hitchhiker's always looks like they're in some sort of slightly dishevelled, you know, quasi, you know, damsel in distress sort of thing.
Is that the case with all the hitchhiker stories?
It varies. You know, sometimes she's in a wedding dress. Sometimes she's her clothing seemed to be in some disarray, was one quote.
No, but I mean, the general hitchhiker stories that have proliferated, are they 90% women?
Yes.
Really?
Usually women, yes. So, I mean, I think, they are projections of, you know, the contemporary cultural kind of conditions. And, I mean, if we go back to Derrida, for example,
let's go back to him.
I mean, there's a tremendous film by Ken McMullen called Ghost Dance that Derrida is in, that he does. And there's one part in that where he says something, I can't remember the exact quote, but he says something along the lines of, well, you're now seeing me as a kind of cinematic revenant. I am a ghost now to you because you're seeing me on film. You're not seeing me in the present.
Right.
So there's a sense in which film, video, and all these kind of moving image medias, when they're representing images of human beings that have either, you know, existed and are now dead or continue to exist. You are seeing a ghost, whether that person is still alive or not. So I believe in those ghosts.
Is Siri a ghost? Is Siri a ghost in your phone then?
Certainly is, yes. It's not me.
What's that? What did you say?
The iPhone, which I must admit I don't have, but Stephen does, you can ask Siri various questions.
Oh, right.
About things.
Yes. No, because I think Siri has never existed as a human, so...
Does that matter?
Siri is a bot, you know, a robot.
But that's an interesting aside in the contemporary digital world that of fleeting presences of people representing themselves as something else, sometimes a different gender for a variety of purposes and reasons. And, you know, we can't be far from, well, I suppose we're almost already there with Siri, of the whole idea of, you know, I mean, for example, when you're on Facebook, you get people asking to be your friend who maybe they say, I want to be your friend because I've heard that Stormbugs track or something.
Yeah.
And so I have a number of people, don't have thousands of people, don't get me wrong, but I have a number of people who I've never met who have European names, which is neither here nor there, but they may not even exist, these people. They post things. Mm. I've no way of no. So we're entering into that kind of...
But there are kind of rational explanations for all of those things, including the presence of people on film and video. I mean, you know, Derrida's image on a film is a perfectly rational explanation for why his image will appear in a film, because somebody filmed him and it's there on the celluloid or whatever it happens to be. But I suppose what I'm asking is this issue of there is a ghost story at work here, which is the sort of beginning point of your project. That's Halloween's coming up, you know.
I mean, I mean, I think what it's effectively a ghost sighting is a kind of projection without apparatus, which I always found quite appealing. You could do away with cinematic apparatus. You do away with that camera and the projector. So that's certainly how I would see a ghost sighting, as something which is a projection without apparatus. So, you know, the person is intangible, but it's a projection as much as you were saying, you know, Ken Mullen and a projection of Derrida. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much to Philip Sanderson and Stephen Bull for... No, really. It's great. Thank you very much for coming in. I thought maybe we could go out with one of the tracks. I mean, perhaps we could briefly tell me something about the soundtrack of the film. There was a very nice... the one where it repeats...
Round and
Round film of the same name. Isn't there a film of the same name? So it's repeated over
Oh, the song. Again? The little song. Yeah. That's on there somewhere.
Which one is that? Which one is that on there?
Let's have a look at the track list. That would be track 5.
Track 5.
This is deconstructing the operations of the radio studio here.
The song of the film.
It's the song of the film, yes. Something strange on Bluebell Hill. Judith takes a fatal spill. In the film we see it all. The film of the same name. Sometime back in 88, Angie's hands rest on a gate. Blue rust sack, magnetic tape. The film of the same name. Something happened on the marsh, dragging back along the path. Roofnuts spotted in the grass, the film of the same name. One swing on the pendulum, two eyes round the pylon, three along the rail lines, film of the same. With glass head pins, electric stream, don't fall in, around the fort and back again. Film of the same name, film of the same name, film of the same name, film of the same name.
I thought I liked, what I was interested in about Goth was that it was, there was kind of some, quite a lot of ideas in it, but it was very open-ended, and there was a simplicity in it, in the fact that there was the music and just watching someone in space, in a landscape, right, doing something, which gives it a sort of momentum, and yet it's actually a very unresolved film, so that...
Right.
The sequences we shot today, I don't even actually remember, so I don't know what that series was.